From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Madeline Brand.
I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. If the rumors have it right, and in this case they probably do, Apple will introduce a slate computer, sometimes called a tablet, later this week. Other tech companies are expected to follow suit later this year. NPR's Laura Seidel reports on what a slate computer is and why anyone would want one.
If you're not sure what a slate computer is, you aren't alone. A few years back, many HP executives couldn't really figure it out either.
I'm trying to convey what a slate device was 5 years ago. It was a little hard to get the executives to understand what would be the use for that slate.
So HP's Phil McKinney took them on a trip to the final frontier.
These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise.
For many years, slate computers have been popping up in Star Trek. In the show, they are flat computers without keyboards used to enter data and retrieve information.
The future for slates is you'll have slates just laying around the house. You'll just have them laying around the office. You'll be able to pick up that slate. You should be able to connect to your information. You should be able to have the interaction experience that you want.
For slates, the future is now. McKinney says even though there have been attempts to market them over the last decade,
what you're seeing is really a perfect storm of innovation from the standpoint of processors, operating system, touch technologies, and the ability to bring that all together to hit a mainstream price point.
At this year's Consumer Electronics Show, Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer showed an HP slate during his keynote address.
I think many customers are going to be very, very excited about.
It was thin, about the size of a novel, with an all-glass front. It offered up everything that Amazon's Kindle e-reader has, but more.
As you see, I can flip through the book using the touch experience. I can experience the book in full color. I can, of course, go and buy and download more content from Amazon.
There are long-standing rumors that Microsoft will release a new slate computer of its own. In an interview with NPR, Microsoft's Ballmer played down the size of the market.
We'll sell 300 million PCs in the next year. There'll be 150 million smartphones sold in the next year. And most of the forecasts are for single-digit millions, maybe, of slate computers.
But there's a good chance that Apple is going to try to prove Ballmer wrong. Right now, rumors are flying that Apple will release a slate PC later this week. Gartner research analyst Mike McGuire says there's a reason so many people are excited about a new Apple product.
What Apple does is takes those existing paradigms that are nice functional devices and turn them into something unique. It may look familiar, but it's the total experience it delivers is unique.
The iPod was not the first MP3 player. The iPhone was not the first smartphone. But Apple made them popular. McGuire believes an Apple slate is likely to offer not just books, but videos, music, and movies, all with interactivity and an internet connection. So imagine you're watching a movie on your slate. You can't remember the name of a particular actor.
And instead of having to go, like, scan through the movie to the end credits, just say, wait a minute, title of movie, you know, who's the guy in the blue suit?
When Dr. Jacob Nielsen, an expert on technology usability, tries to describe a slate PC, he doesn't look to science fiction. He goes directly to magic, Harry Potter.
The newspaper is called The Daily Prophet. It comes with these photographs that are all kind of moving images because of the magic of Harry Potter and the wizards. But in a tablet, all the photos could be movie, could be video clips.
Nielsen sees two possible technological hurdles for Apple or any company to overcome. Tablet PCs can't be too expensive, and they have to have enough battery life. Still, if Apple nails it, at least some analysts believe that tens of millions of people will buy slate and tablet PCs this year. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
So here's the scene. There's a man or a woman hunched over a keyboard, tapping in codes and commands, maybe to steal some sensitive information or hack into a government database. And then, inevitably, a message flashes right up on the computer monitor. Access denied. This movie scene is such a cliche. It's practically expected in every thriller or action film. And yet, if you look at those sophisticated computer interfaces in films like Mission Impossible or The Bourne Identity, well, they don't really resemble anything that exists in the real world. Our producer, Petra Mayer, has been digging around, trying to find out why what you see on a movie screen looks nothing like what you've got on your computer at home. And Petra, what'd you find?
Well, I found a guy called Mark Colleran, and he's a visual interface designer. And he's one of the guys that thinks up those computer screens that you see in movies. And so what he told me is when you see that big red axis denied and it's flashing and it's blinking, the idea for that actually comes from video games. And it all goes back to the 80s. So do you remember War Games?
With Matthew Broderick, right?
Mm-hmm, exactly. And that came out in 1983. And you have to remember, back then, not everybody had a computer at home. They weren't all that familiar with what computer screens looked like. But what Mark Colleran told me is they did know about video games.
So the actual design cues came from games. So it's like the game over thing. It's a big word that splashes across the screen and tells you exactly what is, you know, happening. And that is the whole point of those things, is that, you know, is to tell a story. How do you tell somebody in 2 seconds on screen that they can't get into that thing?
By putting access denied on the computer screen.
Exactly.
Now, Mark Colleran, we should say, did not work on War Games, right?
No, I think that was a little before his time.
Okay, so what movies has he worked on?
A ton of blockbusters. The Bourne Identity, Tomb Raider, Mission Impossible 3, Children of Men, Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
Wow.
Have you ever seen the last Bourne movie, The Bourne Ultimatum?
Yeah.
Right, so there's a scene where Matt Damon is in London and he's trying to meet a reporter at Waterloo Station.
Right, Matt Damon's a CIA agent. They're trying to kill him.
Mm-hmm, right, so he and this reporter are on the run from CIA assassins in the middle of Waterloo Station.
Right, and there's a shot of CIA operatives, like, you know, watching him on a surveillance feed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Give me all of CCTV's eyes.
On it, sir.
So you hear right there, the head CIA guy is saying, you know, get me the surveillance video from the station. And the technicians are clicking, 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 and then there it is. It's on their monitor screens. So what's actually happening is, you know, those technicians, they're actors, right? They're just clicking away on dummy keyboards. They're not connected to anything. And Mark Colleran and a bunch of guys like him are sitting off the set, and they're, what they're doing is when the CIA guy says, get me that video, he just presses a button on his computer and beep, there it is, on screen.
So it looks like they're interacting with the device, but what is actually happening is we're watching them do what they do, and we have ways of controlling it and firing it off and queuing it up so it looks like they're doing stuff in real time.
Now, a minute ago, Petra, you mentioned that Mark Colleran worked on that film, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, with Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. They play a married couple who are both assassins.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And there's a scene I remember in that film where Brad Pitt's computer pops up, and it is the most ridiculous computer I've ever seen.
Hello, John.
Good morning, Atlanta.
It's got this sort of triple panel monitor, rises out of his desk, speaks to him. I covered the Pentagon, Petra. I've been to Northern Command. I've seen some pretty cool computers, but this is just so over the top. I mean, all these mini windows, real-time views, graphics.
Yeah, but you know, you'd be surprised how many of these things actually end up on the market at some point. I mean, Mark Colleran told me, you know, he's looking at video games, but he's also looking at prototypes from companies like Microsoft and, you know, things that are going on in university software labs. And occasionally, something will end up on the market that looks an awful lot like something that he designed for a movie.
Like what?
Do you remember that movie, The Island, with Ewan McGregor?
Yeah.
Yeah, it came out a couple years ago. Mark Colleran designed a tabletop, sort of a touchscreen, interactive tabletop screen. And a few months later, Microsoft came out with this thing called the Surface Computer.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which was pretty much the same thing. So, you know, you never know. One of these days you might end up with as fancy a setup as Brad Pitt.
That's our producer, Petra Mayer. Petra, thanks.
You're welcome.
And you can see a slideshow of some of Mark Colleran's famous movie computer screens at our website. That's npr.org. If this was the internet 15 years ago, then this is the internet today. What was once a collection of static pages has become a kind of theme park of fully interactive websites, videos, and games that play right in your browser. And much of that is thanks to a program called Flash. It's the subject of today's installment of The Net at 40, our occasional series about the history and culture of the internet. Now, the Flash player is what allows you to watch videos on things like YouTube and Hulu, and to see things like this.
This land is your land. This land is my land. I'm a Texas tiger. You're a liberal wiener.
This was the famous Jib Jab cartoon from the 2004 election, and it was made with Flash. The program is integrated into a bunch of web applications like TurboTax, not to mention many of those online games that make the workplace a little less productive.
It definitely made the internet more fun and more lively. It would have been a much more static and quiet place if not for Flash.
That's Tom Fulp. He founded the online Flash community called Newgrounds.
Whether you're good at drawing or good at programming or good at music, you can inject that talent into Flash in some form to create something.
And the man who dreamed up Flash? His name is Jonathan Gay. 17 years ago, he had a tiny startup software company, and he was designing a drawing program for what was the latest technology back then, the tablet computer.
A lot of architects actually liked the software, but the tablet computers didn't take off, so we had to try a different approach.
So how did the idea come about to develop Flash?
One of the key inspirations is we were at a trade show, SIGGRAPH, where all the 3D guys making 3D animations for movies go every year. And a lot of people told us our drawing program would make a great animation program. And we thought, that's kind of a good idea. It'd be fun to do. But, you know, there's only so many people wanting to make videotapes.
But then he thought about this new thing that looked like it might catch on. The World Wide Web.
We became aware of it and said, hey, maybe we could put it over the internet.
The program was originally called Future Splash. Later, its name was shortened to Flash, and it became an immediate success. Microsoft and Disney both used it to redesign their websites. And by 2002, Flash began to support video. And it was what the folks behind YouTube decided to use when they launched their website 3 years later. Again, here's Jonathan Gay.
One of the key differentiators with Flash that really made it, you know, one of the standards for video on the internet is the fact that the video plays right in the web browser. The other video technologies were really separate players that you had to download and, you know, activate separately.
Now, Flash isn't without its critics or its minor annoyances. For example, have you ever tried to open a web page and had one of these pop up on you?
Congratulations. You've been selected to receive 2 iPod Nanos.
You can thank Flash for that as well.
Earlier this hour, we heard about the launch of Apple's new product, the iPad. Among many functions, it's a device for buying and reading books. And the publishing industry is hoping the iPad will do for books what the iPod did for music. But author Eric Weiner is worried about the growing popularity of the ebook, and not necessarily for reasons you might expect.
The other day I was in a cafe when I noticed a woman reading a Kindle, Amazon's clunky, oddly quaint e-reader. Do you like it? I asked. Yes, she said, beaming. It's great. I can travel with 200 books, a library at my fingertips. Being an insecure author, is there any other kind? I asked if my book happened to be among those lucky 200. She punched a few keys in her Kindle and up popped my book. Well, not my book exactly, but the same words that appear in my book. There's a difference. The printed word has a permanence, a finality to it that digital ink lacks. Digital words are provisional, always subject to change. Call me Ishmael. No, call me Brad. Yes, that's much better. Much of the talk about ebooks has focused either on technical issues or questions of pricing, but that misses the point. The technology will improve, especially now that Apple is in the game, and I'm confident that I'll still get my fair share from each ebook sold. But as an author, I'm not after your money. Well, not only your money. I have my sights on a much more precious commodity. Your time. We enter into an unspoken pact, you and I. Give me a few hours, stolen moments on the subway or after the kids are asleep, and I promise to inform and entertain you. Frankly, that's always been a tough sell, given the sundry ways you can spend your time. But at least I had a fighting chance. Curled up with a Pinot Noir in my book, your attention was mine to lose. Not anymore. The new generation of e-books will, in essence, merge the laptop and the book. Now, if my narrative starts to drag or I digress, readers can click onto their favorite news site to see what's up with healthcare or click onto TMZ to see what's up with Brangelina. How do I compete with that? I realize that, no, you can't stop progress, and yes, I suppose I could take the I-don't-care-how-they-read-me-as-long-as-they-read-me approach, but that would be naive. Technologies are not neutral. They come with a bias, not a political bias, a narrative bias. A news story broadcast on television, an acutely visual medium, is different from the same story published in a newspaper or broadcast on radio. Form is function. Someone reading a book on their Kindle has a fundamentally different experience from someone reading the same book the old-fashioned way. The fact is that books are special. Why else are we so careful not to bend their spines? Why else do we grant them honored space in our living rooms, our bedrooms? I can't see people expressing the same reverence for the flashing bits of data that flicker across their e-reader. And don't even get me started on what this means for book signings. Yes, it's wonderful to have a library at our fingertips, but the digital library is a noisy, crowded place filled with sports stars and politicians and celebrities. I'm afraid you might not even notice that I'm there, too.
Eric Weiner is the author of The Geography of Bliss, One Grump's Search for the Happiest Places in the World. He's also a former NPR reporter, and you can comment on his essay at the opinion section at npr.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announces a major initiative this morning on U.S. policies on internet freedom and security. Whether Clinton speaks to it specifically or not, her speech will be colored by the recent allegations that more than 30 American companies have had computers hacked by China. We've been hearing mostly about Google because it has threatened to pull out of that country. It's told China it no longer will censor its China search engine. Alec Ross is Clinton's tech guru, and he's leading the State Department efforts to deal with global problems using technology. When he joined us in our studios, he emphasized that companies like Google should not have to worry about cyber attacks.
I mean, the ability to operate with confidence in cyberspace is critical. Cyberspace provides a platform for innovation and prosperity and the means to improve general welfare around the globe. So this allegation has come and produced a significant level of concern on our part, and that's why we are looking to the Chinese government now for an explanation of it.
And if you can elaborate, how does these latest events play into Secretary Clinton's new initiative on internet freedom and security?
So Secretary Clinton plans to lay out a vision and a series of policies for protecting longstanding American values in a networked world. The recent news about China and Google has obviously gotten our attention, but what's gotten even more of our attention is the fact that 31% of the people in the world are now accessing the internet on a censored internet. The Secretary of State regards internet freedom as a global issue, and there are a lot of other aspects of this that are very concerning. There are so-called honor killings in the Middle East where young women are being beaten or being killed because they access social media. There are extreme examples of censorship throughout much of the world. So we really are engaging on this country to country, and where our strategies will adjust and be appropriate to each country context.
How can the U.S. back up any demands it makes of countries like China or Iran or Syria to allow freedom on the internet?
So one of the things that the United States has done for years but hasn't spoken much about is the role that we have played helping people at the grassroots access an open internet. Some attention was drawn to this when it became public that we helped play a role encouraging Twitter to keep its networks up in the Iranian election aftermath. I predict that you're going to see more efforts on our part so that citizens around the globe that want to access an uncensored internet are able to.
Okay, so, you know, encouraging Twitter to stay up during the demonstrations in Iran, so you're coming at it from the angle of the outside. What is the thinking of what can be done on a government-to-government basis?
Yeah, so one thing that we can do is we can elevate this as a matter of our foreign policy. Until President Obama went to China and made internet freedom a central human rights issue of his trip at the Shanghai Town Hall, internet freedom was a piece of foreign policy arcana. Both the president's elevation of internet freedom at the Shanghai Town Hall and now Secretary Clinton's giving a major policy address about internet freedom signals that this is something that's going to be at the table when we sit down with foreign ministers, when we sit down with our interlocutors, the world around.
Well, I guess you're all diplomats, so it all sounds like, though, the power of persuasion rather than anything very muscular.
The power of persuasion when it's Secretary Clinton is pretty significant. I also would highlight some initiatives of ours, which is to empower people at the grassroots. Part of what we're going to be doing is putting tools and resources on the web freely for people around the globe to understand how they themselves can protect themselves in a networked environment.
Alec Ross is Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's Senior Advisor for Innovation. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Renee.
I'm Ira Flatto, now here with Flora Lichtman, our digital video producer. Ooh, we have a good one this week, don't we? Our video pick of the week.
Hi, Ira.
Yeah.
Yes, we do. It's sort of related, right? So we were just talking about what's in your water bottle, but
right.
What about what's in your fish sticks or what's in your chicken fried steak?
Or your hamburger.
Or your hamburger.
Or that hot dog on the street. Don't you worry about that hot dog from the vendor.
And we have good news for hot dog lovers. People, listen up.
Because your video pick of the week actually went out and...
We met up with two young investigators who basically DNA tested 200 animal products, mm-hmm. including a New York hot dog. So the story takes place at in high school. And if you're getting heart palpitations and sweating like me, don't worry. This is a friendly, we're in friendly territory
friendly
here.
Friendly territory.
these are science students who use this technique called genetic barcoding with the help of a professor mm-hmm. at Rockefeller University, Mark Stokel, to look into what things in the supermarket, things in their refrigerator are made from.
And so did DNA tests on the samples of these.
They took samples. So basically they took samples and then they sent the samples to the Natural History Museum in New York, and the Natural History Museum sent them back DNA code
right.
that they could use to identify what species were present in the samples that they sent.
From like a dictionary of DNA codes,
yeah.
right? Of an encyclopedia.
Right. The codes needed to be in the database to be able to identify it.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're in the database, then you know, okay, is my hot dog made of cat or is it beef?
Mm-hmm.
And
is that real fish I'm eating, or is it a squid or
right,
something like
right.
that? Right.
That and
sort of.
And they got, I think, some pretty surprising results. So let's get to the hot dog, because I think that's...
No, you have to go watch the video.
Okay, never mind. You'll never know unless you watch the video.
It's film at 11, as they okay. say in the industry. But if you go to our website at sciencefriday.com, where Flora's video pick of the week is up on the left, you'll actually find out what's in a hot dog when you eat that hot dog. And how many other stuff, the things?
200 other items. And a few things were mislabeled, mm-hmm. we should say.
And then they had like a one of these serendipity moments,
yeah,
right?
This is the best part. So first of all, these kids, Matt Kost and Brenda Tan, are like the most sophisticated seniors in high school I've ever talked to. I mean, mm-hmm. they just are excellent explainers. And they said that one of the samples they tested was an insect. Ubiquitous in New York.
New York, ubiquitous. Can you guess what that is?
I think you can.
Right, scurries around at night. It's a cockroach.
It's right. a cockroach, and it was found in their advisor's apartment, actually. And they, you know, sent it in. It looks like an American cockroach. Seemed like the same old thing. And they found out, and this is pretty amazing, that it was quite different from any other cockroach in the dictionary of this database of DNA
genetically
codes.
Speaking, it wasn't like anything else.
It was right, exactly.
Yeah.
And so that means that they may have discovered a new species of cockroach as part of this experiment.
Wow. And can you imagine in New York an undiscovered cockroach, a new species?
Who knows how many species of cockroach are scurrying around?
Does that mean they get named after them, the species?
Apparently, yeah, that's the convention. If it turns out, you know, they're sending all their materials to the cockroach expert in the UK,
right.
and if it turns out that this really is a new species, because they tested this one, and then they actually had to go back and collect like two dozen others from the same
goodness.
Building. So I think
take about a minute and a half.
Yeah, you want to ruin the building, you could just name it after
right.
you know 101 Madison Avenue or whatever.
But that's not the place. So that was a bonus. So they not only tested the food, and on the video pick of the week, you get to see them test the food and learn about what's in a New York City hot dog.
Right.
But to see them discover, I guess, where their food, there's cockroaches, right?
Right.
Get to see.
Circle of life.
Circle of life. Get to see this new species of cockroach.
Yeah. And I think they had some, I think it's worth checking out just to see what other things were mislabeled.
Yeah.
You know, what some things were labeled one way and came back another way.
That's Flora Lichtman's video pick of the week right there on our website, sciencefriday.com. Top left corner, you get to see the video. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
Great, as always. That's about all the time we have for today. Our program is produced by Christopher Taliata, senior producer Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora is our producer for digital media. Shelley Du Bois is our Sci Arts producer. Neil Rausch is our technical director, and he's at the controls here in New York. We also had help in Second Life from Lynn Cullins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and the University of Denver. But if you'd like to take Science Friday and shove it, you can. Right into your pants pocket or your purse. Take the show and shove it right in there with our new Science Friday app on your iPhone. We have a new app, and you can download that and take Science Friday with you on the road and make it easy to keep up with the back editions of our podcast and our video and Flora Lichtman's videos. Podcasts are on there also. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.